From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The tell-all book by journalist Michael Wolff, detailing the first 6 months of the Trump administration, is already a bestseller, only days after its release. Wolff spent months with first the Donald Trump campaign and then in the White House, seemingly coming and going as he pleased, taking advantage of the chaos that has marked the Trump presidency. In his book, Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House, Wolff details in unsparing terms the president's terribly short attention span and pathological narcissism, and exposes the internal warfare between various factions comprised of Steve Bannon, Reince Priebus, Jared Kushner, and Ivanka Trump. Wolff helps make sense of the relentless barrage of poorly thought-out executive orders that emerged from Trump and the madness of Trump's method. When excerpts of the book were published in New York Magazine and The Guardian last week, Trump threatened to sue the publisher. Instead of backing down, the publisher moved up the book's release date by 4 days. Trump has also taken his war with the now-ousted Bannon to new depths, referring to him on Twitter as, quote, Sloppy Steve. My guest is Doug Henwood. He's a political economist, editor of Left Business Observer, author of After the New Economy and My Turn, Hillary Clinton Targets the Presidency. And like me, he spent the weekend reading Fire and Fury. Welcome to the program, Doug.
Oh, always good to be here. Thanks.
Thanks so much for joining us. So, you know, when I was reading the book, it felt, I was quite grateful that there was a journalist who did what many more journalists ought to have tried to do, which is sort of take advantage of the fact that there was this chaos in the White House to plant himself as a fly on the wall and observe everything that went on inside. His book has been dismissed by some, and of course dismissed by a lot of Trump supporters, but even dismissed by some on the left. How do you value the overall contribution of this book to our national discourse?
I think it's quite important. I have to admit, I like gossip. I read Page Six daily, the New York Post gossip page. So when people say it's only gossip, I say, that doesn't work for me because I do like gossip. But it's extremely high-end and important gossip and very well written. And Wolff is a smart fellow. So he's full of intelligent commentary as he's reporting the most extraordinary facts. And, you can say that, oh, yeah, we knew a lot of this already, and we did know some of it already. But to have it confirmed, have your suspicions confirmed, to see it all laid out in a sequence like this with, you know, a really good connective tissue of argument and analysis, it's a major, major achievement. And I love Wolff's explanation for how he got away with it, was that the White House is so disorganized, and I presume still is, that nobody had the responsibility to tell him to get lost. So he was able to just walk in and out for about a year, I believe. I just watched this chaos unfolding. Nobody is in charge. The president himself, an absolute ignoramus with a volatile and dangerous personality. And then, you know, that vacuum at the top left, all these competing factions to try to make policy, but with no coherence at all. Nobody in charge. None of it makes any sense. And, the larger thing I draw from this is that a society that can produce Trump as its leader and his administration as, you know, its executive branch. Marx's famous phrase, the executive branch is the organized, you know, the organized ruling instrument of the ruling class. If we have an executive branch like this, we're really in deep trouble. And I think that's the thing that we really need to look at. All these attempts to blame Trump on the Russians or whatever. No, he's our guy. He's a deeply American character. The hucksterism, the ignorance, the pride in ignorance, it's all deeply American stuff. But also, you know, he's a product of our very deeply flawed democracy, the role of money, the role of the Electoral College, the drift rightward of the Democrats. It's all there. And, you know, reading this book forces you to stare just what a disaster it is, straight in the face.
And we'll get to the issue of Russia and the money, but one of the things that jumped out, and this was among the excerpts that were released early from the book and published widely, was the fact that the Trump campaign basically assumed they were losing. And we all sort of, just as, you know, shocked as everybody was when he won November 2016, he was perhaps more shocked than anybody on his family, his campaign. Let's talk about the fact that this whole campaign was launched in order, basically the folks that were involved were all trying to get something out of it. For Trump, this was to a way to push his brand. He was going to win by losing, because now he'd be this even more famous person. But all of the others who came along, Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway, they were all excited about the prospect of losing, because losing was going to further their message. They never expected to win. Doesn't that mean that they basically used our electoral process for their personal gain?
Yeah, it's an extraordinary story. And we also, again, this is one of these things we suspected all along, but, you know, here we do have confirmation of it in the principal's own words, or, you know, principals telling another principals. This really makes Hillary's loss to this clown all the more striking. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we thought, you know, the two worst candidates in modern history, the two most unpopular candidates in modern history, perhaps ever, and she lost to the most unpopular, the second most unpopular, lost to the most unpopular. But not only was he unpopular and, you know, appallingly incompetent and suited to the role, he wanted to lose. And as you point out, they both all had material reasons for wanting to lose. Bannon was the only one who thought they would win, which, when Trump won, made him think Bannon was a genius, after all. But Kellyanne Conway thought this could move her, as Wolf put it, from being a pollster in down-ballot races to being a major cable TV star and pundit. Trump himself thought he and Ailes and Bannon could launch some kind of competitor to Fox, with all the guys who've been bounced from Fox for sexual harassment, like Hannity and Ailes himself. So they really not really expected they were going to lose, but wanted to for, you know, base monetary reasons. It's just it's a striking story of, I can only say it's a really a debased culture, a debased society that can produce characters like these.
And then, of course, when he did win, very quickly, Trump convinced himself that all along, this was the plan, that all along, and I want to quote from the book, and Michael Wolff writes, not only would Trump not be president, almost everyone in the campaign agreed he should probably not be. Conveniently, the former conviction meant nobody had to deal with the latter issue. So when he won the election, he quickly convinced himself that, okay, he was going to jump into this role. Melania was in tears and not tears of joy, wrote Michael Wolff. But suddenly, this machine he had built around him for his campaign was wholly unprepared for an actual presidency. None of them had given thought to what kind of president he would become, right?
Right, yeah. And these are all like second and third rate people. You know, these are not, you know, your usual people who staff campaigns, people with governmental experience. None of these people had any experience. As Wolf puts it, Bannon at the age of 63 was the oldest inexperienced person ever to work in the White House. And, you know, here is this very senior level at the outset. It was an extraordinary array of incompetents who thought that this presidential campaign would make them some money, make them famous, but not actually require them to do something. Or, as you say, face the fact that their leader was an absolute dolt who didn't have the temperament or the intelligence to be the chief executive. It's an amazing story. There was no clear politics to what, you know, he made all these sales pitches during the campaign. He's going to bring the jobs back. He's going to make America great again. But he also said he was not going to cut Social Security and Medicare, you know. And actually, Wolf quotes him at one of the cabinet meetings saying, why can't Medicare just cover everyone? So, you know.
That was perhaps my favorite line in the book. But
yeah, but, you know, there's tremendous intellectual policy vacuum from the guy behind the desk. Into which stepped all these Republican functionaries like McConnell and Ryan, who have an agenda, who had a very awful agenda. Trump didn't know any better, so he just signed it all over to him. I mean, there's a story in that Wolf tells a story about how Ryan came to be so important to Trump. Trump didn't understand the first thing about how to deal with Congress. And like, he really doesn't understand the first thing about anything. I mean, Wolf makes this point over and over again. You know, it's not a figure of speech. This guy really knows absolutely nothing about anything, but doesn't realize he doesn't know anything. He thinks he knows everything. But he didn't have any idea of how to manage Congress. He heard something about how LBJ was really good at getting things done through Congress. But of course, LBJ spent years in Congress himself, really knew how everything worked, was a master of the details of policy. He really knew what was going on. Trump, of course, course, none of those things. So like Ryan comes in one day and talks to him, sells him this bill of goods. And Trump figures, oh, this is going to solve my problem with Congress. I'll just turn it all over to Ryan. So that's how we get it. Ryan controls the Obamacare appeal, which turned out to be a disaster. And then the tax bill was Ryan's baby, which, you know, of course, Trump thought, oh, I'll cut taxes for people like me. That's a great deal. But, you know, as far as the larger policy issues behind that, he had no idea.
And so into that vacuum, right, steps Steve Bannon, because as we now know in the book, Steve Bannon literally went through Trump's speeches and have this famous little white, well, not famous, now we know, Michael Wolff's book will make it famous, that in his little office, his unassuming office in the White House, Steve Bannon was there trying to keep track of all of the promises that Trump made and trying to bring some coherence to the Trump agenda and really creating the idea of Trumpism, which was really Bannonism, because sometimes Wolf alludes to Bannon almost being sort of suggestive to Trump about what his agenda should be and making him think that it was his idea when sometimes it might have been Bannon's idea. So at least while Bannon was in Trump's favor, would you say that Bannon, as per this book, was really the puppet master?
Yeah, well, he's the only one who had any ideas of how to govern. I mean, he had a political philosophy. I mean, kind of crackpot, but he did have a political philosophy, which nobody else around there did. Now, you know, I've got the professionals like Kelly and McMaster and Mattis trying to, like, you know, bring some kind of traditional right-wing Republican sensibility to governance. But at first, you know, it was just Bannon was really the big guy in there. I ended up with kind of a perverse admiration for Bannon. I mean, he's a vile figure in so many ways, but the guy is like, thinks in some sense, which nobody else around there did. And he, you know, he's strongly dedicated to a political philosophy. He has a zest for conflict and confrontation. You know, there's a story in there about the travel ban, which was issued a week after Trump took office. Some people in the White House are asking, why did you issue this on a Friday when mm-hmm. it made it very easy for people to go to the airport and protest? It was going to be all these scenes of chaos and protest. Why'd you do that? And Bannon said, that's exactly the reason you choose that Friday. I wanted the snowflakes, the liberal snowflakes, to come out and demonstrate. So, you know, he wanted to provoke this confrontation.
And I'm so glad you honed in on that. Let's actually, I want to read the exact quote. This was, why did we do this on a Friday when it would hit airports hardest and bring out the most protesters? Almost the entire White House staff demanded to know. That's why, said Bannon. So the snowflakes would show up at the airports and riot. That was the way to crush the liberals, make them crazy, and drag them to the left. Doug, what does this say about how the alt-right as a whole, of which Bannon is the titular head, uses, what does it say about their strategy for the left? Because on the one hand, does the left want to fall prey to this, to this provocation? But on the other hand, we can't not protest.
Right. I mean, how do you react to something as outrageous as that travel ban?
It's a scorched earth policy almost.
Yeah. But, you know, these are conflicts in American society, and all these Democrats who, this violates the core rule of Bannonism, you don't play with your enemies. I mean, he was like, you know, your enemies are your enemies, and you don't try to make nice with them. That's another thing I kind of admire about the guy, in that, politics is about conflict. And we're in the situation in this country now where we have a tremendously divided political system, and with a Democratic Party that's trying to talk bipartisanship, reaching across the aisle, with a group of people who want to destroy you. That's certainly, not just Bannon, but I think a lot of the Tea Party types, or the, what are they calling themselves? The independent, their new name in Congress, the son of the Tea Party. The Freedom Caucus, yes. These guys really want to destroy liberalism, anything resembling liberalism, certainly anything to his left. And I don't see how you can avoid that kind of fight. And you know, Democrats now talking about running Oprah in 2020. I mean, are you really kidding me? I mean, what is wrong with you people? I mean, get serious. These things, the stakes are way too high.
It's almost like, so the alt-right got their celebrity in, we'll get ours.
Yeah. And it's really worked out quite well for them. For everyone, right? Yeah. It's great to have Trump. We need our own Trump. Does that make any sense? I mean, Oprah, I think, probably knows a lot more. Probably considerably more intelligent and probably knows more than Trump does. I wouldn't want to compare the two in that sense. But, She doesn't. It's important to have experience in politics and governance if you want to be, you know, play this game at the highest levels. And I don't know. People are just not thinking very clearly.
So let's talk about this issue, because Trump, of course, one of the things that he took most seriously from the book was the fact that Wolf alluded to his mental inability to handle the job. This has been a source of much speculation over the past year. Some folks say, well, that insults people struggling with mental illness to imagine that they're incapable of doing these sorts of things. Others might say, well, why do you imagine that Trump has sort of mental struggles with mental illness? Why don't you just assume that his narcissism is a product of being rich and greedy? But this is what Wolf writes. Wolf writes that Trump was lacking in what, quote, neuroscientists would call executive function. Trump's brain seemed incapable of performing what would be essential tasks in his new job. He had no ability to plan and organize and pay attention and switch focus. He had never been able to tailor his behavior to what the goals at hand reasonably required. On the most basic level, he simply could not link cause and effect. And then, of course, Trump does probably the worst possible thing he could do by tweeting that he's, like, really smart and a stable genius.
I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up. It's just, it's beyond...
I mean, I can't believe we're talking about presidential politics in these terms anymore. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, you beat me to it, because that was exactly the passage I was thinking of, that the lack of executive function. Of course, people can do all kinds of things with mental illness. There's something deeply wrong with Trump, though. I mean, there's something, he just can't think. He deals only in personalities. He has no conception of how anything works. He can only understand, you know, he's like, it's all about personality to him. It's like, you know, I got to beat Comey because Comey's the bad guy. Hillary was the bad guy. None of the traditional things that one thinks of politics is about, you know, as Margaret Atwood once said, who does what to whom and can get away with it. He's not really, that's not the level he's operating at. It's just Vendetta or whoever talks to him the most recently. That's, you know, his thought for the day. It's just, he's just completely unfit for the office. And, people say, so what? You know, a lot of presidents have been like this in the past. Nixon was crazy, but Nixon knew what he was doing to some degree. And, in his final days, he was certainly, it was a good thing that Kissinger and Hay kept the nuclear football away from him. His drunken ravings. I hope they're keeping a football away from Trump too. But he really takes it to a new level. I mean, you do have to be some kind of narcissist on a very grand scale to want to be president of the United States. I mean, there's just, you can't have all your screws fully screwed in if you want to be president. But on the other hand, you do have to be able to function. You do have to be able to process information, make personnel decisions. You know, the buck stops there, as you know, the sign on Harry Truman's desk said. Now, of course, the modern president is handled. The flow of information is controlled by the staff. What the president does and knows and says is all heavily scripted by staff. But, you know, in the final analysis, the president does decide things. This man really is unfit to decide anything.
He's broken the presidency, which is interesting, right? And this is the thing that, of course, makes him so attractive to somebody like Bannon, the fact that he is a disruptor, that he does things so differently. And this presidency, which is what Michael Wolff was able to take advantage of in slipping into the White House unnoticed and essentially, capturing these inside politics. Now, one of the things that I think is critical for us to be able to talk about, which forms a lot of the book, are these battles between the various factions. And let's talk about that, because what we learned from the book confirms much of what we had kind of guessed from leaks, that Bannon had been trying to undermine what he called Jarvanka, the Jared Ivanka group, get his agenda. Reince Priebus from the RNC was there to try to get Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell's agenda forward, which was, you know, repealing and replacing Obamacare, tax reform, etc. And Jared and Ivanka's agenda was what exactly? Some sort of pro-Wall Street, socially liberal, fiscally conservative type, almost democratic approach to policy. So you had these, would it be fair to say you had these sort of three competing forces that Trump kind of had to, whoever spoke to him last would have most influence?
Yeah, that's what it's looking like. And of course, Bannon is out now. And yeah. Bannon's agenda is very much opposed to both the other wings. Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about, he's a nationalist, anti-globalist, very skeptical of finance, even though he had some time at Goldman Sachs. Then you have, you know, the Jarvanka and also the New York Goldman Sachs wing, Gary Cohn, Dina Powell, who were basically Hillary-style Democrats. And then, you know, the traditional Republicans, like Priebus, of course, he's out now. It's amazing how many people are out in less than a year. You can't make a coherent sense out of that. And they got their tax bill through because that's the one thing that the corporate class in Wall Street are really united on. They just love tax cuts, especially if they're skewed to them. But once you get anything beyond that, it gets too complicated. And it's really hard to see how this kind of dysfunctional machine can get anything done. And then you also have, you know, divisions within the House Republicans as well, the House and Senate Republicans. It's just, Alex Coburn used to love gridlock, perversely, because, you know, that meant the government couldn't do anything, which is basically a good thing, given who makes up the government. I'm not sure I would agree with that. But undermining the imperial presidency is also a fascinating thing. Trump has done more damage to U.S. dominance of the world than, a generation of anti-imperialist struggle could. Yeah. It's been a remarkable thing to watch.
Yeah. So in terms of getting things done, we keep going back to Bannon, and I'm wondering if Bannon being out, he's apologized to Trump, has left Trump with any lessons for how to actually get things done? Because what was dangerous last year in 2017 was that we saw, you know, first with the Muslim ban and then with, you know, one executive order after another undermining the administrative function of the government by reducing and slashing budgets. Bannon, according to Michael Wolff in his book Fire and Fury, said just doing things became a Bannon principle, the sweeping antidote to bureaucratic and establishment ennui and resistance. It was the chaos of just doing things that actually got things done, except even if you assumed that not knowing how to do things didn't matter much, if you just did them, it was still not clear who was going to do what you wanted to do. Or a corollary, because nobody in the Trump administration really knew how to do anything, it was therefore not clear what anyone did. And so Bannon had this way of just, you know, the whole Muslim ban, he had to basically Google how to write an executive order, and then Trump signed whatever was put in front of him. And it's possible that many of the executive orders signed last year with things that Trump just signed without reading and nobody really read them, because just doing them before thinking them through became a tactic that the Trump administration seemed to employ. And I'm wondering, with Bannon out, he's going to continue that tactic. I mean, he's just announced that TPS for Salvadorans would end, almost as a way to deflect attention from this book. I don't know.
Yeah. That reading that stuff about Bannon reminded me of a phrase from the poet Wallace Stevens, deluging onwardness. That seemed to be the principle of governance. We can get lost in this not being able to get anything done business, because, you know, we've got Scott Pruitt at EPA dismantling every environmental regulation that's ever been imposed. We've got ICE that cracked down on immigrants, which is grotesque, brutal, xenophobic mission, which they're, you know, really having an effect on people's lives, and very many people's lives, and very dramatic effect. So they are getting some awful stuff done. They couldn't succeed in repealing Obamacare, but they're going to chip away at it piece by piece. And I'm certainly not the biggest fan of Obamacare, but it was better than nothing, considering what, you know, the Medicaid expansion and the subsidies for people to buy insurance have brought health insurance to, you know, tens of millions of people. Good thing, not good enough, but certainly better than nothing. They want to undo that. At least Ryan and the congressional Republicans have Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid in their sights. Trump has said he doesn't want to touch that, but, you know, Trump says a lot of things, you know. You wondered if he's going to learn any lessons. I don't think the guy can learn lessons. He can't remember, you know, something from morning to afternoon. He lives entirely in the moment with no memory, no sense of the future. He reminds me of a cat in that way, although much, much less charming.
Let's talk about the media and the right-wing media in particular, because while there were, you know, battles between the sort of political strategists internally, there were also battles between various media personalities who, you know, had a hand, some of whom had a hand in bringing Trump into power and then wanted to find a way to control him. You had figures like Roger Ailes, you had Rupert Murdoch, and of course, Steve Bannon himself, who came from the media and who relied on funding from the father-daughter duo of Robert and Rebecca Mercer. What did you learn from Michael Wolff's writing in Fire and Fury about the role that, you know, figures like Joe Scarborough as well played in trying to shape Trump? I mean, the media should never have this cozy a relationship with the presidency and the executive branch, but they do, and that goes for Democrats too.
Yeah, I didn't make this up. I'm stealing somebody else's insight, but I can't remember whose it was. So I consider that some kind of credit being given to someone else. But you know what Wolf did was to violate a norm of journalistic practice, which is journalists know a lot of these things and don't report them. So the kinds of, you know, things that page after page in Wolf's book that are reported, like what people say in moments of candor about their colleagues. Or their adversaries, just gets buried under a coat of politesse in order to maintain access, because you don't want to offend the people who are going to give you leaks or whatever. Wolf violated all those confidences. He probably violated some off the record strictures in writing this book, and God bless him for it. People have reported on what a jerk he is, what an unlikable, arrogant character he is, what a fame and money hungry character he is. But that's the only kind of person who could have written a book like this. Somebody who knows that world and probably has some contempt for a lot of the people who inhabit it and gets pleasure out of humiliating.
He's a longtime critic of the media. And in the book, throughout the book, he actually does critique mainstream media. And he's alluded to the fact that he said whatever he needed to say to get access, which was probably to let Trump know that he was on his side when it came to media coverage of Trump. I think he sort of laid the groundwork even for his access by critiquing how the New York Times covered Trump in order to have Trump take him for granted so he could be a fly on the wall. But he got the story.
Yeah, I mean, that's what really counts. And it's a very important story. And you know, all these people who dismiss this as scurrilous or sensationalist, you know, they really lighten up, guys. And this is an important story. But I was really surprised by the contempt that Murdoch has for Trump, because I thought all along that Murdoch kind of might have liked him, that, you know, came out of the similar New York social circles. But Murdoch is, you know, an evil guy, but he's really a genius at doing media. He really knows what he's doing. And I think he had nothing but contempt for what an idiot and ignoramus Trump is. And it really comes across in the book. Even Ailes had some pretty harsh things to say about his longtime friend. But then when Ailes died, Trump didn't even call they were friends for like a couple of decades, right? And Trump didn't even call his widow with condolences. He manages to have no social graces, like no sense of humanity, no empathy. The greatest pleasure he gets, it seems to be, is boasting about his own accomplishments and humiliating other people. I mean, that's really a very bad personality type.
Let's also talk about corporate power. Here's one interesting quote that I thought, especially since you cover economics, Doug, that I was really startled, not startled, but it sort of confirmed what we knew all along about Wall Street. Surprising and sudden business and Wall Street affinity for Trump, writes Michael Wolff. Although few major company CEOs had publicly supported him, with many, if not all, big companies planning for a Hillary Clinton victory and already hiring Clinton-connected public policy teams, and with a pervasive media belief that a Trump victory would assure a market tailspin, there was suddenly an overnight warming. An anti-regulatory White House and the promise of tax reform outweighed the prospect of disruptive tweeting and other forms of Trump chaos. Besides, the market had not stopped climbing since November 9th, the day after the election. And of course, today, Trump credits the absolute explosion on Wall Street of, you know, stock prices just huge as how he is making America great again. So what are your thoughts on how Wall Street were suddenly like, Clinton's our friend. Oh, no, it's Trump. Oh, Trump can be an even bigger friend.
Yeah, and the connection between the stock market and American greatness is hard to measure. But it's very clear that what all that the corporate elite, when we're talking about Fortune 500 companies or Wall Street investment banks, all they care about from the political sector is deregulation and tax cuts. They really have, I mean, they have agendas specific to their individual industries or companies, but they have no broad agenda other than deregulation and tax cuts. It's very striking contrast with the late 70s, early 80s, when corporate America had a very detailed agenda about how it wanted to get out of the malaise of the 70s. Reagan pretty much accomplished what they were out to accomplish, and they felt, oh, that was a success. And they kind of demobilized politically. So all they lobby for now, Hillary Clinton was their favorite candidate. She was the favorite candidate of mainstream Wall Street and the Fortune 500. Now, like wildcat oil drillers and frackers and some like hedge fund and private equity guys, they're the ones who like, the Koch brothers, they're the ones who read their Ayn Rand. But like Goldman Sachs and General Electric and companies like that, Hillary Clinton is their kind of figure, very establishment, not likely to rock the boat, and certainly not doing anything very hostile to business. They certainly would not have welcomed a Bernie Sanders presidency, but that kind of corporate Democrat they feel very comfortable with, even if it's not their ideal choice. But once it became clear that Trump was going to offer them tax cuts and deregulation, all their previous reservations about his lunacy and unreliability and volatility, they're all like sidelined because they were going to be able to drill wherever they wanted to drill and sell whatever toxic financial products to the public they want to sell and have their tax bills reduced very substantially. That's all they cared about. And he won them over that way. I don't see any signs of discontent coming from that quarter by any
Right.
means.
And essentially, that's been the story of this presidency and the story of this book, which is that everyone, because Trump is so unhinged, those people who have the greatest access to him have been able to use him, the public good be damned, because it's the public that has the least access to him. So Bannon was able to get his Muslim ban through, Priebus and Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell were able to get their tax reform through. Even Kushner and Ivanka just have a cozy relationship with the presidency and are, the Wall Street and the corporations have been able to get what they want through, except for poor people, people of color, workers, women, the rest of us are the ones who have really been thrown under the bus because these various forces have been able to so effectively use this unhinged president.
All you have to do is flatter him, really. I think that goes a long, long way.
And
But
that's why no
there's
one's
some of the
interested in
stuff,
impeaching him.
right? And some of the stuff in the book about the Middle East hasn't got as much attention as it should. Like the work with Saudi Arabia. They really, what's his name? MBS or his initials? I can never remember his name. The new crown prince of Saudi Arabia was basically installed or promoted by the Trump administration. There's also some stuff in there about Jared Kushner's relations with a bunch of shady characters in Israel and Trump was actually running around saying that Jared's mission of peace in the Middle East would be simplified by the fact that the Kushner family knows all the crooks in Israel. That's what, that's Wolf's quote. That's not me. So there's this comfort with despots. We knew about that already, but his affinity for people like the Saudi royal family and MBS, the Saudi guy.
The Mohammed bin
It,
Salman bin Abdul
right,
Aziz Al Saud. Yeah, King
who
Salman.
is very
Crown
Trump-like, a
prince.
total ignoramus and a rich playboy who knows nothing. They bonded on all that. And, that's how foreign policy is made,
And
who Trump feels comfortable with.
this is what Michael Wolff specifically had to say about foreign policy in his book, Fire and Fury. The president's views of foreign policy and the world at large were among its most random, uninformed, and seemingly capricious aspects. His advisors didn't know whether he was an isolationist or a militarist, or whether he could distinguish between the two.
It says, yeah.
He's a good writer. Wolf is a good writer.
Yeah, he is. And but, you know, this really does seem like I've had the feeling that this country has been falling apart for the last several decades. But the pace of it is accelerated. And the fact that we can choose this gang of leaders as you know, install them with power over the executive branch. And then the damage they're doing now that they're there. I mean, it just seems like it's all the rate at which this country is falling apart is accelerated considerably. And it's a scary thing. I've got a 12-year-old kid. I really feel, you know, I've always taken the climate problem as something that, you know, I'm sorry to hand you this world, kid. But now the, you know, just the general social and political collapse that the Trump administration represents and is accelerating, you know, I take it really personally now, it seems. Mm-hmm.
So finally, let's get to this Russia issue. Michael Wolff has an interesting position on it. He was able to quote Bannon quite a bit. One of the first things that came out from the book that I thought was interesting was Wolff's position on how the left viewed the Russia issue. He said, much of the left, which had resoundingly and scathingly rejected the intelligence community's unambiguous assessment of Edward Snowden as a betrayer of national secrets rather than a well-intentioned whistleblower, now suddenly embraced the intelligence community's authority in its suggestion of Trump's nefarious relationships with the Russians. And so what came out of this book also was this idea of how the intelligence community could essentially rev up this issue of Russia collusion and in the investigation because they didn't like Trump, because Trump routinely insulted them. What do you make after reading this book? Did you gain any new insight about this idea of Russian collusion? And if so, you know, what Trump's goal was? Was Trump even smart enough to collude with Russia?
You know, I've been skeptical of the Russian story all along, and I've been very disturbed by the way Democrats and liberals have been eager to promote some sort of quasi-coup against... I hate Trump, and the process by which he was elected is grotesque, but he is the legally elected president, and the idea of having the intelligence community, as we're now sort of crunchily calling it, promote the... deposing an elected president, I don't know, that seems like a bad precedent. It's not something you really want to establish. But that aside, there's some interesting stuff in it. Like, first of all, if Trump at all really didn't want to or expect to win, why would they have colluded with the Russians? That's one aspect. But the other one was, like, Bannon says some interesting stuff in it. Like, so I think it was Ale.
Treasonous and unpatriotic was how he described what happened. But he also said that it was essentially money laundering, right?
Yeah, I mean, the money laundering angle is interesting. And, you know, Bannon kept saying, watch out for Jared because the Kushner's money and probably Trump himself. You know, they're you know, all these years in real estate, they come across some really dirty money. And somebody like Mueller, who is obviously a very skilled and experienced and disciplined investigator, could probably turn up some really ugly stuff about all of them. So, you know, who knows where that's going to go. But I think it was right at the beginning where Wolf is recounting the dinner party that was held at his own Greenwich Village townhouse, where Ailes and Bannon talk to each other at length. And Ailes asks Bannon, what about this Russia stuff? And Bannon said, it's, you know, Trump had this big crush on Putin and wanted to impress him. And Putin didn't give a damn about him. So Trump kept trying. That was an interesting point of view. Like, you know, this idea that they were colluding somehow and that Trump, that Putin didn't really care about Trump, which is the way Murdoch seems to have felt about Trump, too. That's an interesting perspective that we need to consider because, you know, this idea that, you know, Vladimir Putin was manipulating to get Trump elected. I never found that very persuasive, but after reading this book, I find it even less persuasive.
Right. And so that's another thing that the book sort of contributes to the discourse. Well, there is plenty more to talk about. I'll end with the an Andrew Borowitz satire piece about the Fire and the Fury, which you know, he's sort of like the Onion. Andrew Borowitz writing that the Trump White House staff has been forced to act out the Michael Wolff book Fire and Fury for this non-reading president, so that he could figure out what was inside it. So it certainly. I mean, you sort of have to laugh after you finish crying reading this book, right, Doug?
Yeah, it's really, you can do both at the same time. It's really hard to figure out, but it's really a very good book. And all these people are dismissing it as, you know, retreaded gossip. No. It's, you know, smart, well-written, and very much worth reading.
Well, Doug, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your insights.
Thank you.
My guest has been Doug Henwood, a political economist, editor of Left Business Observer, author of After the New Economy, as well as My Turn, Hillary Clinton Targets the Presidency. We've been discussing the new Michael Wolff bestseller, Fire and Fury, inside the Trump White House. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.